everybody, and welcome to today's IRTP call on the 17th of May, 2011. On the call we have Michaela Nalen, Mike O'Connor, James Baddell, Paul Diaz, Bob Mountain, and Jeremiah Johnston has joined as a replacement to Simonetta Battigier. From staff, we have Marika Koenigs, Christina Nordstrom, and apologies from Rob Golding, Kevin Erdman, Simonetta Battigier, Matt Serlin, Anil George, and Oliver Hope. And may I also please remind you to state your names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you, and over to the chair.
Thank you. Could you also note apologies from Chris Chaplow as well, please?
Yes, I will do that.
Thank you. I got, you're going to love this, 2011. I got a direct message from his wife on Twitter about his attendance or lack of it for today's meeting. Anyway, as per usual, does anybody have an update to the statement of interest or declaration of interest? Going once, going twice. Mikey, are you still a capitalist?
Aye, aye, sir.
Thank you. Okay, then. Right, then. Today's meeting, just before we get started, welcome to Jeremiah. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. Who is here as... See, I won't say replacement for Simonetta, but that's terribly offensive. He's here as a representative of CEDAW, as the other representative of CEDAW couldn't make it onto the call. How's that?
Sounds good.
Convoluted, I know, but I'm Irish, so I do call... Ah, proxy. I don't know about that. Then we get into privacy and proxy, and my head starts to explode. Anyway... So welcome to the call. I circulated your statement of interest to the other working group members earlier today, and hopefully Simonetta has brought you up to speed on what we are discussing.
Yes.
Cool. Perfect. Right then. Now, there's a couple of things that we want to go through. The roll call, we've already done that. The emergency action channel is something that we have been discussing for the last couple of weeks. Then we have the 60-day lock proposal, and then there's a little bit more on the reviewing of public commons. For those of you on the Adobe Connect, you will also see so the working group guidelines with respect to consensus are there, so you can see what we're talking about when we're referring to different types of consensus. Does anybody have any issues, questions, queries, or anything else at this time, or shall we proceed? Okay, moving on. Several of us were at a regional meeting in Munich last week for a couple of days, where there were various members of ICANN staff, including several people from ICANN Compliance and several people from the Registrar Liaison Group. The deliberations of this working group did come up under a couple of topics, and Compliance does have a new director who we had the pleasure of meeting. Now, I can't remember how to pronounce her name. It's Maggie or Magui. How do you anybody else who was there, can they remember what's the correct pronunciation? Maggie? Okay, we'll go with Maggie.
Maggie.
Okay, because I know it's spelt oddly, or at least oddly for me. So the compliance team, kind of reflecting general kind of things that we discussed previously, so... Maybe we might be able to get some more input from them in future PDPs on IRTP. James, I believe, was discussing the emergency action channel over breakfast with Tim Cole, and we've reached out to Tim to see if we can get a few bullet points from him. But now I'm going to be really cruel and put James on the spot and ask him, can he recall anything that did come up in that conversation?
Yes, Michaela James speaking. And again, this is not to say that there's a specific ideas or information. I just want to be sure that we accurately captured Tim's information when we reviewed it as a working group, I think it was about 4 or 5 weeks ago. If I recall, if memory serves, when we were discussing how radar, the radar system, might support the emergency action channel idea, I think the general takeaway from the working group was that it could not do this in its current state and would require significant development. I don't think that was the entirety of what Tim was trying to convey. I think he was also trying to give us some alternative suggestions that might help us in the immediate term support the emergency action channel idea using existing systems. And I think it was that second part that perhaps might have been lost. So I don't want to put words in his mouth. I don't want to promise that he has some information that isn't there. I'm concerned that we maybe didn't accurately review all of what he was trying to communicate to this group. So my recommendation would be if we could reach out to him and just have him restate what he was his earlier positions and put them into a few bullet points, and that way we can be certain to get them into the record as in their entirety.
Okay, thanks, James. And sorry for putting you on the spot. Marika, please go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. I did already reach out to Tim, and I hope he'll come back and me with some bullet points shortly, and as soon as I'll get those, I'll share them with the list. But just to note as well that some of the previous emails did already have his input as well, specifically on radar, because I had been talking to him about how this could work, and I think where he provided feedback as well, and some of the more complicated areas would require significant changes to the system, but some of the more basic functionality could probably be accommodated in radar. So as I said, as soon as I hear back from him, I'll share that information with the mailing list.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's correct. My takeaway from the chat was that maybe we focused a little too much on the negative aspects of what he was saying, and we missed some of his suggestions. And that was all I was trying to convey.
Okay, thanks, James. Sorry, my browser, things are exploding here as happens every time I'm on a call. Mail just quit. Okay, then. Moving back to what we're looking at in terms of the emergency action channel. Marika has captured some of the changes in the version that is up on the screen in front of you. Just looking at that. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. I can just highlight what changed between for version 7 and version 8. The main changes here that we changed in the last paragraph on the first page will to may in relation to the transfer undo. And I've added at the end of the document under the implementation recommendations, I've tried to capture our recommendation that the policy following implementation should be reviewed in a 12 to 24 month time span. And what I tried to do as well, indicate some of the areas that specifically should be addressed in such a review. And I would appreciate the working group's feedback, whether there are other items that should be added or whether further detail or less detail should be added with regards to which item should be specifically considered as part of such a review.
Okay, perfect, Marika. Thank you very much. Does anybody have any issues, queries, or questions or anything in relation to this at this time, or is everybody relatively happy? Okay. Okay. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, just to I think just as this is Bob, sorry. Just as we were wrapping up last week, I just voiced some concerns over the lack of a fixed time frame. So I wouldn't say I'm completely happy with the verbiage that we have. I'd just like to voice that that one concern that I have.
Okay. Has anybody got a constructive suggestion for how to address this time frame issue? Or even a destructive suggestion. I'm open to anything at this stage. Does anybody have us? James.
Yeah, I have a probably a not a very good suggestion. But I mean, I think that, you know, we've right now, the way it is, it's almost open to interpretation to be infinite. You know, you could certainly say that when, you know, when a transfer occurs, a new year is added to the registration period. And one thought would be, well, you know, certainly, you know, it would have to occur within that year, because if you were going to back out a transfer that had an additional year of registration term, then you would essentially be backing that out as well, and now you've got this kind of zombie registration that shouldn't exist anymore but still out there walking the streets. So I know that's not what Bob is after, but I was just thinking of it terms, and it, you know, just purely in the abstract, you certainly wouldn't want these things to go beyond the extra year that was added to whatever expiration date they had originally. I don't think that's helpful, and I don't think it addresses what Bob's after, but it is just an attempt to put some boundaries on this problem.
Okay, thank you. So, okay, so one parameter then is what you're saying is maximum of 1 year after the original expiry. James?
Well, yes, that's what I was saying, but, it, you know, I don't know if that's a very constructive recommendation, but it certainly puts the stake in the mud out there, yeah.
Okay. The mud reference is interesting, too. Maybe I'm overanalyzing. Mikey?
This is Mikey. I think I'm going to pose this question to you registrar types who see the hijacking patterns. I mean, my concern all along has been that if we put a specific date in this policy, we're essentially presenting a target for a hijacker to wait, essentially to hijack the domain in a stealthy way, and then to wait until whatever date we put in this policy. And then, as soon as that date has passed, continue to complete the theft of the domain. And so I guess the question I've got is, in the patterns of hijackings that you've seen, especially the stealthy ones, how often does that kind of behavior happen? You know, is this, I mean, we've got a sort of doubly compounded data problem. Part of the problem is that we don't have real good available data for the frequency of hijackings, but then we also don't really have good data for how this hypothetical would play out. And so I have the same concern with 1 year, 5 years, 200 years, because it seems to me that at some point we're presenting the thief with a methodology to complete their plan.
Okay, Barry?
Hi, Michele. Sorry, I was on mute. This is Barry. Yeah, just to kind of back up what Mikey was trying to say here, I mean, I can see both sides of the debate here, and certainly, you know, I can sympathize with the aftermarket community, you know, wanting to, you know, protect their domains. I guess my question to you, Bob, is, you know, I can understand why you want some more certainty around this aspect of the EAC, but, you know, when we started down this road a while back and we interviewed surveyed the aftermarket community, I think the biggest takeaway there is that that community didn't really see this as a problem, and that if any one of their high-value domains ever did get hijacked, they were more than comfortable with the recovery capability of their domain, because it's definitely such high visibility. So I'm almost wondering if we're, you know, if going down this road of trying to put a cap on when the EAC can be invoked, does it even make sense when, if in fact a bad actor tried to steal a domain after X date, that domain probably wouldn't be stolen because it is part of an aftermarket community, or even if it was, it's probably highly likely that it would be recovered anyway, if that makes sense. Thank you.
James? Oh, sorry, Mikey. Beg your pardon. Mikey, then James.
Sorry, that's an old hand.
I'm very tempted to make a comment about that, Mikey, but I will resist.
sorry.
But if you do that again, I won't be able to fight the urge. James and then Bob.
Yeah, James speaking. Thanks, Kelly. And this question is for Bob. I thought that changing the will to may might have addressed your concerns. I think, as I understood your concerns earlier, that it was infinite. It was open ended. There was no boundary on this. And I think that was a significant problem when you considered that the transfer undo would be automatic without any discretion. I'm wondering if changing the will to may alleviates some of your concerns about having a time frame, or is there just no connection between those two issues?
Michele, can I respond?
Yeah, of course. Please.
This is Bob. James, I think it definitely helps the may, but it also, on the other hand, just continues to introduce uncertainty, which I think is going to be a problem in that there aren't just really tightly defined rules. And I totally understand that the tightly defined rules, as Mikey's point, gives a blueprint to the hijacking community. However, as Barry said, the aftermarket was essentially saying, again, this isn't just for the aftermarket, but the aftermarket was saying that hijacking is just not that big of a problem, and we believe that the proactive measures should be emphasized rather than the reactive measures, of which I think they're going to view this. At any rate, I think even the may gives you an undetermined amount of time, which, again, reasonable, but it's still, I don't think is enough to really bound this thing in a way where people aren't going to respond thinking that they have a domain which could be clawed back, after an extended period of time after they purchased it and assume they owned it. So I think it definitely helps, James. I'm just still uncomfortable with the sort of uncertainty that we're positioning here.
If I could respond pretty quickly here, Michele.
Oh, please do.
Yeah, Bob. I can appreciate that. I guess what I'm saying is, since we've left the time frame open and we've removed the link to an automatic undo, we have the same degree of uncertainty that we have in the policy today. I could, for example, instruct our domain services team to go and try to get a name back. Call another registrar, let's say Paul. Put him on the spot here a little bit. You know, and our team could call Paul's team and start to try to call back a name that's 30, 60, 90, 100 days old now. It doesn't mean we're going to get it. It doesn't mean that he's not going to tell me to, take a walk. I guess what I'm saying is I don't see how this is materially different than the situation we have today, because we have decoupled it from an automatic action. Therefore, the time frame to me has become significantly less less crucial, and really, except for the fact that the registrar is on the hook for answering in a shortened period of time, from the registrant's perspective, I don't know that it's any more or less certain than the status quo.
Yeah. So my understanding, the way it works today, it is registrar to registrar sort of relations that resolve these situations, right?
Most of
the time? Okay. And that the intent of this is to be applied where we have an unresponsive registrar? Is that correct? So you have there's somebody in Myanmar who's just not answering the phone, and this gives the previous registrant a way to get it back, yeah?
Well, it says essentially answer your phone, right?
Right, nowhere else. Does this now, with the new loosened wording, help the Myanmar situation?
It's not ideal. I think that a lot of us were discussing last week that we're not happy with the we're not happy that the consequences have been watered down. I think Mikey was particularly frustrated last week. I think a lot of us feel like it falls short of something that's really going to help address those situations. But I think that over time it will accumulate enough incidents where a registrar fails to respond that we can then go to compliance and say, now here's something you have in policy that you can take some sort of action on these folks.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I mean, there's not a straight line between failure on the EAC and reversal of a single transfer. It's much more of a, you know, sullying their record, I think, over time in order to build a case that other action should be taken. But I don't want to be speaking on this. I mean, please, other guys, you know, anybody else, see it differently. Please jump in.
I'm just going to put myself in the queue as well and just jump both Mikey and Paul and Bob. Just for the record, I am trying to maintain a certain degree of neutrality as working group chair, which is why I have deferred to the other registrars as much as possible on this, though obviously as I'm a human being, I can't manage that all of the time, just for the record. With respect to the entire thing about getting registrars to pick up the phone, the story that we tell quite often is about James trying to contact some small little registrar in Northern Europe, I think it was about 18 months ago, and ended up having to contact me on, I think it was Good Friday or something, to see if I had a contact with that registrar, which I kind of did, because there was no way for James to contact them through normal channels. Right, Mikey, then Paul, then Bob, and what was my poor choice of words, Bob, or do I want to know? Maybe I don't want to know.
Wasn't that my choice of word for hijacking community?
Oh. Well, see, I wasn't sure what we were referring to. Hey, maybe they've got their own social network. You never know. Mikey, Paul, then Bob.
Thanks, Michele. It's Mikey. I was very frustrated on last week's call, and I do want to apologize formally to the group for that. I was caught by surprise by a couple of things and behaved badly. But I'm better today, I hope. And I think that the other concern that I can accept the version that we have in front of us, and I will encourage the BC to support the version we have in front of us, even though it does fall a bit short. I agree with James that this at least gives us a mechanism to start building a record. And it also gives us the opportunity to come back to this in a year or two and make changes if they seem to be needed. So I'll get that out of the way. The thing about the may versus will that I want to sort of put back on the table one last time is one of the appealing things about will is that it meant that there was no adjudication role for either registrars or registries. It was just a mechanical thing, a kind of binary test. And you didn't have to insert any judgment. The may wording means that the registrar, not the registry, and I think this is important, we need to get back to Barbara on this, is that because the may occurs in the registrar requirements of this policy, it means that the judgment call as to whether to invoke the undo stays with the registrars in this version. And the registry's portion of the responsibility is completely unchanged from existing policy. And I think that's one of the things we need to clarify if we go with this version, is that the registries do not have to play the adjudicatory role. Only the registrars do. And that's something that I think the registrars, if you guys are comfortable with it, I'm okay with this. But as I said, too many times last week, it makes me nervous. That's it.
Paul, then Bob.
Thanks, Michaeli. It's Paul. Look, I don't want to belabor points that have already been made. I think James made it most eloquently. Let's not forget what this EAC is about, people. It's just a communication channel. You know, I get very frustrated hearing terms like clawback and all these sort of things, and it's like, come on, let's look at what's on paper. Some of the things that are being discussed or described are not realistic. And I share Mikey's frustration and absolutely don't feel that you need to apologize to the group. The rug got pulled out from under us last week in terms of a certain group of actors saying that basically they're not willing to do anything when it comes to these hijacking situations, or at least they don't want to be put on any more of a hook than they feel they already are on. You know, so when it's all said and done, all we're doing today is creating, as James already said, bottom line is a mechanism that we can provide compliance with actionable information that they can work with non-compliant, non-responsive registrars. But all of this FUD about, you know, clawbacks and things happening, come on, people, that's not going to happen. And let's also remember, registrars are going to have to be involved. What registrar is going to blindly listen to somebody who's trying to, quote-unquote, claw back a name and risk their own operations, a potential lawsuit, and everything else, unless they're very confident that there's a there, that there's some real case to pursue, a genuine hijacking case. I mean, I think we have to kind of cut through all this. We've spent a lot of time the last couple of weeks spinning out hypotheticals, and it's just not... It doesn't seem it's even worth it to me. It's such a little part of the long tail, given where we currently stand with what's on paper in front of us. End of rant.
Okay, thanks. I'm waiting for the Adobe Connect to reload, so whoever was next in the queue, please go ahead whilst my browser fixes itself.
Right. Yeah, this is Bob. So, I think between James and Paul, I'm getting it. I think one of the other, and it does sound an awful lot like what we have today, which is essentially communication between registrars is used to solve the problem. So in the event of a hijacking, they just talk. The one thing that we did when we in the ETRP, we had the some of the feedback we received was the lack of specifics in terms of what happens if it is abused, though. So, Paul, you remember the feedback. It's there doesn't appear to be – there weren't any specifics on for the downside, which is if it is invoked frivolously or carelessly, what happens then? Is that something that's addressed later, or is that something we could put here to try and assuage that concern?
Does somebody want to answer that?
Yeah, this is James. If I could jump in there, because this was a topic, maybe not last week, but 2 weeks ago, where I sent a message around. And I'm not sure if it was captured in here in this latest version. But, you know, Bob, I mean, I think the way I was viewing it was there's two ways to fail. If you're a registrar, there's two ways to fail at the EAC. One is you don't respond in a timely manner. So that's a failure as a recipient of an EAC. But you can also fail as a sender, and that is by using this for non-emergency, frivolous, or let's say spammy type activities. So I think that, you know, whatever consequences we have left remaining, you know, for a failure to respond to the EAC, where we're just kind of essentially building a record for compliance, I think that the same thing applies to someone who would fail the sender role by spamming the EAC channel with a bunch of non-urgent issues. I think that's what you were getting at. Does that answer your question? But the thing is, I don't see where that is in this report. Maybe Marika can help us on that.
Marika, you have your hand up. So James is calling you out. So this is all perfect timing.
Yeah, this is Marika. I think that question is actually addressed in the frequently asked questions document, because I do recall that the assessment letter, it's the same as with any other policy. I mean, if you, it's probably not in the remit of this working group to, you know, prescribe what happens in those cases, but it's presumably a compliance issue. If you use a policy in a different way than it was intended, or it's clearly written up, I presume there's some compliance actions that can be taken. In response to discussion on timing and you know, concerns or issues that people feel that might need further consideration, I think I would encourage you then to maybe look at the language in relation to the implementation recommendations and specify there that, you know, any review down the line should specifically consider some of those items. So I don't know if you know, Bob still has concerns, if you want to write up there what such a review should specifically address, to make sure that, you know, when the time comes, we have a list of items that the working group at this stage felt that maybe didn't need to be incorporated here but should be considered in a future point of time, in time.
Thanks, Marika. With respect to the compliance issue, do you think, Marika, you could possibly find out from your colleagues in the compliance team a bit more about this? Because I think one of the concerns that I have, and I'm not sure about other people on this group would have, is that we need to be sure that something, that whatever policy that might have a compliance angle to it actually does. I mean, as it will have something that is tangibly actionable, as opposed to something which is left open to something far too broad, wide, and we end up where, well, you know, compliance really haven't got enough to actually do anything about.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know who the best person there is really to talk to about this, but I presume you should be. Sorry?
I'll talk to Pam, because she has been reviewing this policy when we've discussed it internally, so she's, I think, aware of what we're proposing here. So I'll check with her if she feels that the current language, or, you know, in the general context, if, you know, a registrar doesn't follow or abuse a certain policy, what kind of mechanisms are available, or whether there's anything specific that should be written in here to make sure that, you know, compliance has some tools to address in case of abuse.
Okay, but I mean, from my own personal view, and I'm not sure about anybody else's, if the EAC is designed to, how do I word this diplomatically? It's Tuesday. Diplomacy's out the window. If it's aimed at weeding out non-compliant, oh, yes, James is reminding us that there was an entire list of escalating remedies. The thing, yes, but this was during the presentation from compliance last week. But the thing, I suppose, is this, is that whatever we do in the policy, if it's to weed out the non-compliant / bad actor registrar / ones who are incapable of actually doing their jobs, then it needs to do that rather than ending up causing headaches for people who are actually trying to comply. They did actually give quite a good presentation last week. It was a lot livelier than any previous presentation we've had from compliance. Okay, then. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, Marika, just a note on the issue of whether, you know, there's no response. That is written in where, you know, it does say that the losing registrar will report failures to respond to EAC requests to ICANN compliance and the registry operator. So it does, and it says here as well, may result in further action by ICANN up to and including non-renewal or termination of accreditation. So I think we do specifically deal with the non-response to EAC requests, but I understood that question for compliance now relates more to abuse in the way of, you know, using the EAC channel for non-emergency requests, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Does anybody else have any thoughts on this? James has made us an interesting suggestion. There were some slides from the compliance team about possible escalation routes. Just for those who obviously weren't in Munich last week, the compliance team gave an overview of what exactly compliance does and doesn't do and how they do it. And one of the slides was in relation to the possible escalation routes for that compliance can take against a registrar or registry that is not seen to be complying with policy. Marika, could you ask them for some of those slides, do you think, which might actually help us a little bit?
Yes, I'll do.
Anyway, right, moving on. Okay, is there anything further on this particular topic at this time? Oh my God, hands up left everywhere. Marika and then James.
This is Marika. Just to note that I also made a couple of changes to the FAQ based on the changes we made in this document, and maybe just encourage people to review that. My idea is now, following this call, that now I think that we have hopefully agreement on the language here, and as well the FAQ, to incorporate that into the final report, so we have all the language there in one place.
Okay, perfect. James?
Hi, Kelly. James speaking. So, looking at the clock and then looking at the calendar, are we done? Are we close to done? So we've been at this EAC for quite a while, and I've you know, maybe deluded myself into thinking that we were really close before. Each time it's not turned out to be the case. So I guess my question is, maybe by show of hands, or yeah, I mean, can we either declare that this is, you know, being wrapped up with a ribbon on it and we can move on, or are we, or can we at least put out a finite hit list of, you know, I feel like this is almost like a microcosm of the new GTLD program. Is every time we look at it, we see something new wrong with it. So I want to see if we can rally everybody around this idea that we're done with this.
Okay, then would it be helpful, James, if we were to simply do like we did with the 60-day lock and just do a very quick, simple poll to the members of the working group as previously, you know, just basically, do you support it, yes or no? The EAC has currently written it. Keep the question very, very simply, and then we can decide whether we have, which type of consensus we have. I personally feel at the moment that we have strong support but significant opposition. But that's just my own personal view.
The mechanism, you know, of whether we can't do it on the call because we have so many apologies, but I don't know that we need a full-blown poll. If we can just capture everything that we've said thus far and all the changes for this document, put it to the list and say, look, you know, cut off on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you know, whenever, and say, you know, give us a thumbs up or give us your immediate things that you don't support. And I think that, I think that we just basically have everybody put their marker down on the table on this. Thanks.
Okay, no, I think that's a very good idea. Thank you, James. Marika, I'm going to go to you in just 2 seconds. Based on, actually looking at this, I see what Barry was saying. My apologies. Okay, the options with respect to consensus are full consensus, which means that there's everybody agrees. Consensus where there's a small minority in disagreement, strong support but significant opposition, which, let's say, if I was using percentages, let's say if it was like 66 versus 33% or something along those lines, divergence, and then we have minority views. Yeah, you could see how it could be leaning towards consensus. Marika, please, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. For people that want to have a closer look at the working group guidelines, it actually outlines as well the recommended process for assessing the levels of consensus. And I think it actually, although polls are an option, I think it actually discourages polls, as it, you know, does tend to give this feeling of, you know, indeed counting votes and doing percentages, where while the objective is to get to consensus. So the recommended approach is more that, indeed, following all the discussions, the chair makes an assessment of saying, well, I think we have consensus, and puts it out to the group, you know, on a call and also on the mailing list, you know, saying, does anyone disagree? Do we have full consensus or not? And in that way, you can then go through the process. If there are still people speaking up and saying, well, no, you know, I don't think we have full consensus because I disagree, then the question is, okay, you know, is there something that can be done to accommodate you so we do get to full consensus, or do we have a consensus position where you want to file a minority view? So I think the way, you know, the working group might want to consider is, once we have indeed all the recommendations together, is putting them all out and, you know, maybe going through them on a call to see where everyone stands and you know, do a call like that. And I think for at least most of the other recommendations, based on our previous report, there seems to be full consensus on supporting those. But again, I think that's something that we will need to assess once we have the final report and the final recommendations. But that might be an approach to do it instead of doing a formal poll.
Okay. Thanks, Marika. I think I might need to have a chat with you between now and next week, just to make sure that I fully understand exactly what the options are, but I think I'm beginning to get my head around it. Okay, then. Does anybody else have any... I want to get this... I didn't say anything about waiting for the next call, Paul. I was just going to say I was going to talk to Marika before the next call, which isn't the same thing. Sorry, Marika still has her hand up.
Yeah, again, a proposed approach for the specific language. What I can do is basically finalize the text as we have here, basically taking out all the red, you know, red lines and basically calling it final and put it out to the mailing list probably tomorrow and basically saying, look, on the working group call yesterday, everyone agreed with, you know, this version. Is there any opposition, any objection? You know, please speak up now. If not, this is going to be incorporated as is in the final report, and, you know, we assume there is consensus.
Okay, perfect. The thing here is that Barry has put a couple of points. Actually, Barry and James have both put a couple of things in the chat, which are kind of like the highlights of some of the areas of divergence within the group. So, just for the record, the may shall argument. Discussion, debate, semantics, call it what you will. That hopefully has dealt with most of the issues people had in that area. Wait a second now. Then there was the registry minority position with respect to the four-hour SLA. Just for those whose memories are getting a bit weak, they felt that some of the registry operators might not have the staffing levels to be able to deal with an SLA of 4 hours. Was there anything else that was a big bone of contention? Oh, the time limit. Well, the time limit concept, I think we've gone that way. Right. Is there any other kind of big points that people feel there was divergence? Oh, that's under the may shall. Sorry, Barry. Please, Barry, jump in quickly, because you can probably talk fast and you can type. Barry?
This is Barry. Actually, I can type faster than I can talk, but anyway, okay. I was just pointing out that the duration is under the may shall bucket, if you will.
Okay, perfect. All right, then. Mikey, go ahead.
I was just going to do sort of the same thing on the registry concern about the SLA. I thought that on the call last week we pointed out that the SLA only applies to registrars, that we're not changing anything in the registry responsibility here.
Anybody have any thoughts on that?
This is Barry. I would agree, and just what James had put into the chat. I'm not sure if we've got a definitive response back from the registry group. So that's why I still call it kind of outstanding. But for the most part, I believe it's somewhat resolved. And while it's still somewhat dangling out there, I still think it kind of folds up in the consensus realm or level. Thank you.
Okay. Right. So, okay, we have a couple of things with the registries. Okay, let's if we take this to the mailing list, just to go through and just see if we can go to this to the mailing list tomorrow and just ask for people if they agree or disagree with things, and then hopefully any other outstanding matters that we're not aware of will hopefully, fingers crossed, come to the hopefully will be resolved. Now, the other thing was with regard to the 60-day lock, which I would like if we could like to go spend a few minutes on. Now, we conducted a poll, and at the moment, now there were three options: leaving the topic untouched. So whatever way it is now, leave it alone, don't touch it, blah, blah, blah. Changing it so it becomes mandatory, and or voluntary best practice. And if you look at the results there, three people were supportive of leaving it untouched. Go ahead, Marika.
No, go ahead, finish your introduction, and I'll wait.
Oh, I thought you were going to jump in just to tell me I was getting it all, I was getting it completely wrong. okay, so because you could vote in more than one place. So you could say that you could have green, amber, or red. I mean, red you're opposed. Amber, you don't mind one way or the other sort of thing. Green, you're supportive. So, I'm having difficulty reading that. 1568043090. What's that actually mean? Three green? Oh, okay, yeah, sorry. Okay, brain's not working. So there were only three people in support of not touching it. There were six in favor of a best practice, and there were eight in favor of a mandatory change. So, yes, go ahead, Marika. I'll let you now say something meaningful.
Yes, this is Marika. Maybe have a fourth option that the working group might want to consider, as it's clear that there's no unanimous support for one way or the other, and as this is an item that we didn't really put out for public comment either. Another option the working group might want to consider is recommending that this specific issue is considered as part of the next IRTP, so there is some more time to discuss it, explore the different options or pros and cons, have as well opportunity to actually put this out for public comment and community input. So maybe that's the working group might want to consider that as an alternative approach instead of trying to find a middle ground between these three issues.
Okay, Marika, when would we put it out for public comment?
No, I mean, as a part of a next IRTP, my suggestion would be that the working group could also consider providing this to the council as one of the issues that should be taken up by the next IRTP, as we still have C, D, and E to go.
All right. The only thing I would say, and this is based on presenting to the GNSO Council several times over the last, it seems like eons, but it's already less than 2 years, they really don't like stuff being punted to the next working group. They really hate that. They're not going to like that suggestion. Unless, of course, all the councillors have suddenly changed dramatically. James, go ahead.
Yeah, Michele, I was going to say something similar. I really don't think that we should be punting this down. Sometimes we uncover an issue during the course of a working group that we realize is too big and we need to, you know, kick it to a new working group. I think that's definitely the case when we think about the change of control idea. This one, however, has been in our charter since day one, if I'm not mistaken. And the only reason we're catching it last minute is because we spent too much time on other items, EAC and ETRP, and this one kind of got lost in the weeds. I know that some folks feel like it's being rushed. I agree. I believe that that's kind of a collective failure on all of our parts, that we kind of missed the ball on this one. And now we're up to the end, and we've got this loose end. And then I wanted to also mention that for those saying that, you know, we need to put this out for public comment, we need to, you know, we need to discuss this further, I would point out that our last round of public comment specifically asked people to weigh in on this subject, and we received zero feedback on this. So, you know, maybe it wasn't highlighted clearly enough, I'm not sure. I just, you know, I really would be reluctant to proceed, as Marika has pointed out, because I think that this was on our hit list when we first started out. And, you know, if we don't get it done, it's completely on our shoulders that didn't happen. And, you know, I think that I agree that folks believe that it should be more comment, but, you know, there were two windows, I think, where this was specifically asked for comment and received none. So, Just pointing out that I don't think that's a very good idea. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, James. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. James, if I can just then ask you, which charter question do you think specifically asks about this issue? I mean, we do have the question in relation to change of registrant, but we're now talking specifically about, you know, lock following a transfer. So in your view, which charter question does this issue specifically fall?
I'll have to go back. I know that this was not a last-minute add-on, but rather this was a, oops, I can't believe we forgot to address this. So this was not something that was tacked on at the end of the working group. This is something that's just been hanging on there dormant since the beginning. But I'll go back and find the charter if I don't have it in front of me. I keep getting kicked out of Adobe, too. So.
I can put it up now so, you know, people can have a look at it if you want. Any other charter questions?
Okay, here are the charter questions. Ah, oh my God, scary. Whoa, she's changing fonts. My head's hurting. Working group will consider the following questions.
I believe it came under D, for example, because we were trying to figure out whether.
Standards or best practices should be implemented regarding use of a registrar lock status. So yes, that would be under D. Is that okay, Marika?
I mean, we discussed that it was pretty much a universal best practice. We were just trying to figure out whether or not it should be a mandatory standard. So, but it's not specifically addressed in our charter question, but I think early on in the working group, we discussed this as something that needed to fall under D.
Okay. Marika?
Yeah.
You dropped off. Oh, you're there. Okay. Does that address your concern?
Yes, but I do have a concern that I don't think we made any kind of draft recommendations around this issue in the initial report or the proposed final report. So one concern I would have, and I think some, you know, people raise that as well, that if we suddenly put out this recommendation, there hasn't been any chance for the community to actually comment on it. So that would be a concern would like to share with the working group. I mean, if no one else shares it, it's just minus. But I'm looking back at the report just to see, you know, if we had anything in there. But that's something that, you know, the working group might want to consider.
Hey, I know we're up against the time. There was specifically, I have to go back to my original email, and I don't have it in front of me. But I've linked to the point in the report where it says we specifically. The working group is specifically asking for feedback on this issue. So I don't have it in front of me, and I apologize that I'm not able to kind of trot it out here, but if you would like me to find that and send it to the list again, I will do so.
Marika?
Yeah, it is, Marika. I'm quickly looking at the report. So I need, if we've raised it and we've asked for input, I think then, you know, then we're covered. I'm looking as well to see where we discussed, and if I find it, I'll post it in the chat.
Okay, thanks. Barry?
Thank you, Michaela. This is Barry. I'd just like to throw my support in behind what James is trying to push here as well. This is definitely something the group needed to accomplish, and we're pretty close to doing it. And I'd like to carry it a little bit further is, you know, looking at the survey results chart there, I guess it's in terms of trying to lay down where the group's designation would be. If it helps, I'll remove my okay from the best practices. But, you know, if I start to look at that, I think that this is a great exercise to marry against our designation chart of where the working group stands on this position, and then be able to document that support or not support and put it in the final report. I do agree. I think there was plenty of language in the report specifically about, you know, what entails a best practice around the registrar lock and what goes on out there. Yes, we didn't provide specific recommendations or not, but, you know, the community is pretty well informed, and we certainly didn't get any, you know, feedback either way. So, you know, lastly, I'd just like to say, so looking at that chart, at the very least, when I read the charter question, whether standards or best practices should be implemented, at the very least, I can easily say we have consensus on best practices. Now, I support more it being policy than best practice, and so that's why I reiterate, if need be, I'll remove my okay from best practice, and then there's only three people that don't think that this should either be a best practice or a policy. Perhaps we need to document them as a minority position if we go with, you know, we've got strong support but significant opposition for it being policy. We've got consensus easily for it being best practice, and I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Jeremiah.
Hi, yeah, this is Jeremiah. You know, as I mentioned in my statement of interest, you know, one of the hats I wear is with the Internet Commerce Association. And on our board call recently, that group very much does not feel like this question has been debated in the comment period, and they very much want it to be. Speaking for SATO, now, I mean, I can definitely understand how D there is definitely making this an issue that should be addressed, but I think there's a big jump between, you know, a vague concept of standards and best practices to a concrete 60-day lock that's going to have significant logistic impacts on portions of the market. So, I mean, I just don't think it's something that should be pushed without being vetted.
Okay. Does anybody have any thoughts on this? James?
Yes, I'd like to push back on the concept of significant impacts to the secondary markets. You know, I think that what we're saying here, in effect, and let's be clear, is that a name should not transfer twice within 60 days. Not that it can't transfer, not that it's introducing sufficient friction so that it is no longer portable for commercial or transactional purposes. What we're saying is that it cannot transfer twice. My concern is that there's another bit of this sentence, reason for denial, which is that a domain name should not transfer 60 days after it was originally registered. So, you know, if the secondary market is the tail, then there's the dog, okay? That a domain name should not move from the registrar that created it for at least 60 days after it was born. And I'm concerned that if we start tweaking the language in this one, that we're going to create unintended consequences of domain names hopping out of registrars within days or even hours after they were registered there, and what the implications that might be for the not just the security and stability of the DNS, but also for abuse and other types of issues like that.
Well, I'd like to respond if I could.
Oh, please, well, go ahead.
And it's just, well, I mean, I think in theory, I mean, you know, that's all that can be. I could agree with that. But it's, I think in practice, there is many different kind of trades happening under different kind of auspices, and they're not bad. You know, I mean, I think a lot of this discussion seems to, while not blatantly labeling those kind of transactions as, you know, as negative consequences, and, it's certainly implied. You know, and I think the domain owners, as the ones who have the ultimate risk at stake if a domain is lost, if a domain is hijacked, domain owners should have the same. Some domain owners want to flip domains, and I don't think it's necessarily ICANN's position to take a stance on flipping of domains. You know, so if impediments like this are put in that de facto prevent those things, you know, we're using the protection of the registrant as an excuse to take power away from the registrant, and that would concern me. I would at least like to see something that's more narrowly tailored or that gives registrants options rather than locking them into something that, might not be their desire or best interest.
Kelly, if I could respond.
Please, work away, work away.
Well, Jeremiah, I think, and this goes back to some of our earlier conversations, is that, you know, the difference between a transfer and the way registrars use the word transfer and the difference between the way the aftermarket uses the word transfer. A domain name can change control or change owners 100 times or 1,000 times, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about how many times does it change registrars, which I grant, you know, it happens pretty commonly in conjunction with a transaction between two parties, but it's not necessarily a required element that happen as part of a sale. So, you know, I think what we're trying to say is if you're going to have that second transfer in that 60-day period, that it just has to cool off at a single registrar, either the first one or the second one or the third one. You know, go ahead and pick one. But, you know, it should at least spend enough time at one of those registrars in order to, establish, like, you know, that someone has a basis to execute whatever terms of services they're agreeing to.
Well, when you say cool down, I mean, again, that's kind of charged language to me. It implies that, you know, that the flipping is inherently negative.
No. I want to go back to my earlier statement. The domain name can change control 100 times or 1,000 times. It is the movement between sponsoring registrars that we're focused on here.
But an individual choice of registrar is an individual choice, you know, and so...
No, it's not. I mean, there are two things here which keep on getting confused. The change of control and the change of registrar. It is convenient for professional registrants to lump the two together. The thing is, professional registrants are just one group of registrants. There is nothing to stop you from changing registrant multiple times. But what we're talking about here is the change of registrar, which is not the same thing.
Well, and I understand that. And in Thresado, I mean, if anything, we prefer that the domain stays where it's at. It's a hell of a lot easier for us to do our job. You know, but the fact of the matter is that people demand to move them to the registrars where they have the rest of their holdings at. And so if we have these locks in place and people are trying to put together deals and things have to move to, you know, escrow until something can happen, I think it creates, additional risks because you can't just process transactions cleanly and effectively.
Jeremiah, with all due respect, if that were the case, why do you list domain names that are less than 60 days old? There is no way for me to transfer a domain that is less than 60 days old to my registrar of choice. However, Sado will list those domains on your great domains auction platform and elsewhere.
Yeah, it's not ideal, but I mean it's something that we live with, and so we're just, as these things are being discussed, we want the practical implications to be, you know, discussed in light of the practicalities of what we see in, you know, the volume of transactions going over our marketplace. I mean, it's not a hypothetical, and it's our customers demand this, you know, and that's what I'm saying is that, you know, to me it's about registrant rights. It's not about Sado per se. You know, it's not about Sado and what's logistically easy for us. It's about registrants' rights and what's logistically right for them. You know, and I understand the desire to protect them from themselves even sometimes, but that's, you know,
establishing a rule for this rather than it being a registrar-by-registrar decision, you know, and where registrants can choose going to the registrars that have policies that they, you know, agree with, you know, this takes that choice away from registrants. And, again, that's my general concern.
Mikey?
This is Mikey. I'm a registrant, and I think I'm a member of the ICA, although I'm not sure because their billing processes are a little bit sketchy. And I guess I'm going to push back just a little bit on the registrant rights thing because I'm one of the folks who's pretty in favor of this idea, and the reason I'm in favor of it is because of the difficulties that arise when domains quickly skip across several registrars in the process of being stolen. And this is the primary focus of this. The, quote, cooling off period that James mentioned isn't the cooling off of the marketplace. It's an attempt to slow down a bad guy stealing domains from good guys, whether they're domainers like me or businesses or individuals who have, through no fault of their own, an amazingly good domain name and somebody steals it. So one of the concerns that I guess I would like to raise is that there's a fair amount of misinformation out in the domainer community, which I read and I wince at, but I never respond to, because it's being promulgated by people who tend to take pretty extreme actions when you disagree with them. And I choose not to get into those fights. But I am going to push back and say that the domainer community is not unified around this, and that some of us are actually quite concerned about theft. And this is primarily aimed at addressing that concern.
Okay, thank you, Maggie. Anybody else want to weigh in on this? Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I actually have a question that I also posted in the chat because we do have another recommendation that, you know, proposes new language for denial reason 6 that basically also talks about that the registrar must remove the lock or provide a reasonable accessible method for the transfer conduct to remove the lock within 5 calendar days. So I'm wondering if this lock would be mandated, would that fall under the same criteria or requirements so that in principle, there is a 60-day lock, but if a registrant would, you know, provide whatever a registrar requests, it could at that point remove the 60-day lock and transfer out sooner than that? Is that foreseen as part of the discussion, or would it be an exception? I'm just trying to understand how the two would relate, if at all.
James?
Yeah, if I can address Marika's question, I believe that they do not relate to that particular bit of the language, the new language for reason for denial 6. If we go back to my original message, what I was suggesting was that there are two reason for denials that are currently optional that we have discussed making them mandatory. And we pointed out that they are, for all practical purposes, with the most legitimate large market-leading registrars, they are already in place today, which is that if a domain name is less than 60 days old, from its registration date, or domain name is less than 60 days from a previous transfer in, that it cannot be transferred out again for that time period. And what we were talking about doing was taking those out of optional reasons for denial and calling them something else, calling them mandatory reasons for denial, so that a registrar is not in a position where they may deny a transfer, but rather they shall deny a transfer. And anyone who knows me from PEDNR and the other working groups knows that I'm always in favor of registrar flexibility and registrar discretion. However, as we've discussed, I think, in this call, when it comes to security issues, unfortunately, that creates the weakest link type scenarios, and hijackers know exactly which ones to target, which ones are most vulnerable. So I hope that answers your question, Marika, that they were not part of that reason for denial 6, that they would actually go into a separate section.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, anybody else want to venture into this? No? Okay, James, you have a hand up. Is this a new hand, an old hand?
It's an old hand. I keep getting locked out of... I'm having Adobe issues today, sorry.
Don't worry. I'm going to have to go checking plugins afterwards because Flash crashed everywhere, every way, every which way imaginable. Okay, then. With respect to the 60-day lock... Okay, there are a couple of people who have strong opinions against it. There are quite a few people who are happy to make it a best practice. So it moves from being optional to a best practice, which means it's still not obligatory. And then there are quite a few people who want it to be mandatory. So we need to move forward with respect to deciding at what level of consensus we have for each one. So I think we'll do this via email tomorrow. Ultimately, we don't want to punt this to another working group because that would not be reasonable. If we end up where we cannot reach a reasonable level of consensus, well, so be it. But that at least means that we will have done our best to address this. In my own personal opinion, as me, I do not feel that having more extensive discussion of this is going to dramatically change viewpoints. But that's just my own personal opinion. Okay, then. With respect to this at the moment, just to clarify, in my own view, I think we're in a consensus position on this. So in other words, only a small minority disagree, but most people seem to agree. If you... okay. Right then. It is 18 minutes past 4 in my time zone, so I think rather than trying to belabor this any further, I will give you all back a few minutes of your lives. And let's follow up on this via email, and let's try and drive this home in the final run and not punt too much to other working groups. Marika and then James.
Yes, just Marika, if I can just encourage on item 4, if people kind of have a look at the public comment review tool and make sure that I've captured all the response of the working group accurately, because this will be either incorporated or linked in the final report. And I think the last updates we didn't really go through, although, of course, we discussed all the comments, just to make sure that people have a look at that. And in the meantime, I'll start working as well on producing a final report for everyone's review, incorporating the new EAC language and making any other changes that are required to mark this as a final report, and hope to get that to you ahead of next week's call.
James?
Hi, Michele, Jane speaking. Just wanted to confirm perhaps with Marika that looking at the calendar here, today's the 17th, next call will be the 24th, and that's basically it, right, to make the Singapore cutoff?
This is Marika. Yes, the publication deadline for Singapore is the 30th of May, but I think as I already mentioned before, as this is not a report that's going to be discussed in Singapore by the community, we can be a bit more flexible with that deadline. As it is discussed, as we're going to discuss it with the GNSO Council, I think, the earlier we can submit it to them, the better. But as it is not strictly for community discussion, we have a bit more flexibility in the timeline, as I understand the publication deadline for Singapore.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other matters need to be raised? Okay, then. Well, I'll speak to you all then next week and via email in the interim. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, McKaylee.
Thanks, McKaylee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Louise. That'll be all for today.
Thank you. I'll get the recording stopped. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.